You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. Look, I'm no beer expert, but I do play one on podcasts. And that's why you should trust me, and that Oscar Blues Brewing Company is one of the best beers out there, the original people to put craft beer in a can with their Dale's Pale Ale, which, by the way, is also delicious, so, you know, convenient to support that. And they've got all kinds of flavors, 4 different locations, 2 in Colorado, 1 in Austin, 1 in North Carolina. Delicious beers, big supporter of OneOfUs.net, well worth going out of your way to go to the breweries and check it out, where you can get lots of seasonals not available elsewhere, as well as their homemade sodas. Oh my God, they're so good. And just buy them in the store, because you can find their cans all over the place. So delicious. Also, please, if you're not already a subscriber, I mean, come on, as little as $2 a month, $5 a month, or if you want to go up to 10 or 25 as well, there's different perks at every single level where you get lots of bonus stuff inside of the forums of extra podcasts and videos and all sorts of stuff that we do. It is the only reason we're able to keep going. Also, think about liking us on all our various different social media, especially our YouTube page. We'd love to get more likes on there. That does make a difference because we do get ad revenue from those things. So please, if you go on there and subscribe to our YouTube page, that makes a difference as well. I feel like I got a full disclosure here. This movie indeed maybe had a different effect on me than it would have on a lot of people because Phil's time I finally said it. I used to be a very famous rock star.
Oh.
And I faked my own death and decided instead I was going to just watch movies for sort of a living. So that's the truth. And I kind of identify with the Ethan Hawke character in this movie.
Wow. I've learned a lot about Chris today
that
I didn't know before.
I was Jimi Hendrix. It's true.
Jeez.
Yeah.
The best part is we can just discount everything Chris is about to say for the rest of the episode.
Well, you did that anyway.
Exactly. I was going to say, please join me in discounting everything Chris has to say about this episode.
This movie, Juliet Naked, which is about a giant shark that never shows up and eats everyone, despite my fondest wishes for that to happen.
I'm very sorry about that.
I heard they just cut that totally out of the movie.
Did they? Yeah. Okay. It felt like they were going to come back to it. Sorry, we're being very silly. I'm Chris.
I'm Rob.
I am Russ.
It's the Summers Brothers joining us for a highly suspect review of this new release, Juliet Naked, which is the latest adaptation of a Nick Hornby book. I'm a big fan of all the previous adaptations. Even the one that people like to talk shit about, Fever Pitch, is pretty good.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You remember that one with
Drew Barrymore, Jimmy Fallon?
Yeah, exactly.
Fry Brothers, yeah.
Yeah, not bad. Although, you know, I mean, like, I guess High Fidelity is one of the best mm-hmm. comedies ever made, in my opinion, and certainly my favorite book by him about a boy is also really good. And Juliet Naked has actually strangely been praised by a lot of the book has been praised by a lot of critics as the best thing he's ever written. And I believe he himself said, this is probably my favorite book, which surprises me because this is maybe one of the least complicated in terms of like the character relationships of any of the things that I've read by
him. It's always that way with authors, though. You know, their favorite is never everybody's favorite.
Well, yeah, I think that is true. Stephen King taking notes. So this follows around Rose Byrne, who plays Annie. She lives in a small seaside town in England with her boyfriend, played by Chris O'Dowd. And they've been together for, what, they say 15 years?
Is that how long it is?
I think they said 15 years. And it's obviously gotten to the point where they're just not really communicating well anymore. And part of the problem is his weird, hardcore obsession with this disappeared indie rocker from a while before, Ethan Hawke, who had put out one album that was generally received pretty well and then totally disappeared after playing a few shows. And so he runs a website where he and a couple hundred other middle-aged dudes who are obsessed with him chat about all sorts of crazy theories about what happened to singer Tucker Crowe. And it's gotten to the point where it's like a problem. Have you ever met anybody who's like this with something where they've got that one thing they're so fucking fixated on that you're just like, dude, there are other
things. I feel like I'm the person.
Yes.
Everybody feels that way.
Wait, what is the one thing you're fixated
on? Movies, probably.
Well, no, but I mean, movies is one thing, but if it was a movie,
it would be an issue.
Like if you were like,
Star Trek, but having an obsession like that around people who don't have an obsession about something He's difficult on relationships, always.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And he's got a shrine built. Like I said, he runs the website. He's constantly chatting with people. And she's like, yeah, I like him, but come on. And when someone mails him a copy of the raw demos of that one album, he is immediately taken with it to the point of crying by the seashore as he listens to it. And she's like, what, it's not nowhere near as good. It's dreary. It needed all the instrumentation, and it turns into a big fight. And she, out of defiance, writes a comment on his blog about the review of the album, basically calling it totally out as being nowhere near as good. And much to her surprise, who responds in a private email to her but Tucker Crowe himself, Ethan Hawke, with, I totally agree with you. You're dead on. This album, this version is nowhere near as good. And it starts a long email correspondence and budding friendship between the two, right as her relationship with her boyfriend is starting to falter and fall apart. And really, this kind of, the third man of this movie is knowing at some point Tucker Crowe and Ethan Hawke's characters are going to meet, and
Chris O'Dowd.
Chris O'Dowd. Sorry. Tucker. Yeah, and Ethan Hawke's characters are going to meet, and it's going to be chaotic or funny or whatever. And the movie pushes it off as long as it possibly can from happening, to the point where it's almost frustrating. You're like, I really want him to realize that his ex girlfriend is dating,
or hanging out,
with his hero, but. I've basically given the plot with trying to avoid spoilers as much as possible here. What did you guys think of this?
Russ? Wow. So I was really excited to see this movie. Like you said, big Nick Hornby fan. And actually, this book has been on my library list forever as one to read. So when the movie came out, I thought, oh, great. Now I can just see it. It had like a cool trailer. I was slightly apprehensive in the sense that, you know, I've really been burned by a lot of these indie dramedies, you know, like Save the Date or Adult Beginners. I always feel like you watch them sort of expecting one movie and you end up I think this probably is going to sound bad, but I always say, like, I feel like this movie should have been funnier or better. So I was nervous going into that. But I was really, really surprised by this movie. I think it goes next level. It's really great. It all those tropes, it addresses them. It's funny you said that about the movie pushing off O'Dowd and Hawke meeting each other. I actually thought that should be the beginning of the third act. Instead, it seems to take place a lot earlier, and then they just, it happens, but they move on from it. And I think that's where I think the movie shines, is there's a lot of moments that I think in a lesser film would have been cringy or frustrating.
Waiting for the uncomfortableness.
Yeah. And this movie definitely sidesteps them. So, matter of fact, there's a confrontation involving Hawke and his, I keep calling Hawke, but it's Tucker Crowe and his extended family that Rose Byrne's character happens to be there for. That scene, I think, in another movie would have just been a chore to get through. Instead, it's very funny and human and touching. And I think
there's a lot of layers to that.
Yeah, and just like there's a lot of layers to the entire movie. I was just at every turn. I think I was expecting the movie to go one way, and it went the other way. And that was really, really exciting for me.
It's like I always want to say Hornsby.
Yeah, I don't know why everybody does feel that way.
But his characters, like, I was telling you guys when we finished, I would have been able to tell you this was based on a novel by him, even not having read the book after seeing the movie, because you're like, oh my God, it's got to be, right? His characters are always, they're always very flawed, but it's their flaws and their own humanity that both makes them endearing and funny in these stories. And that's true of all the characters here, who's, like you said, that hospital sequence with the whole family sort of all gathering together uncomfortably is at the same time both revealing about these people and their relationship, quite funny, but not in a laugh out loud way, a sort of like, oh my God, this is going to keep building in its way. And also kind of sad. You know, it manages to do all three of those things at the same time.
And in a fourth way, I think it's the first time that that Byrne's character kind of has to deal with the real person of Tucker Crowe, and instead of the fantasy version that she's been corresponding with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the movie,
I think Hornby specializes in sort of man-child obsessions and deconstructing that from all angles, like the value of that, you know, and the relatability of that, and then also the way that it's, you know, arrests your development and into being a full-grown adult, that you're obsessed with something small or pop culture or something like that. So I enjoyed that aspect of the movie. I think that the movie did a really good job with Tucker Crowe in that he doesn't show up and isn't super cool. You know, Hawk's character, like, a lot of times in movies like this, they cut to the rock star who hasn't done anything in years, and they live in this, like, badass apartment, and they're dressed cool, and they're doing shit, and you're always like, God, they make that much money off residuals, and instead, he's kind of a schlub, like, he's got, like, you know, Hawk plays him as, you know, he still dresses cool, but kind of like somebody who's cool in the 90s would dress, and he's got kind of a gut, you know, he's a former alcoholic. You know, he's living on a couch. He barely has any money.
Yeah, God, even worse, living on a couch in a converted garage that rent free because his ex-wife feels sorry for him.
Right, and it's much more. It's a good idea. They don't play it to sort of make him a loser, which was good. I think the movie does. I think Peretz, Hornby, and the screenwriters do a good job sidestepping the really obvious way you would go with this movie, especially in, like, you know, if it was some Netflix movie, it'd be very much on the nose. I think the movie's much more sophisticated than that. I think the only place it falters slightly on that, and I don't know what the solution would have been, was O'Dowd's character as the obsessive guy, because I just think he's played a little cartoonishy. You know, his obsession's a bit much. And then also he... you know, I don't know if the movie really figures out a great way to resolve what I think is a really upsetting thing that, you know, imagine whatever you love, whether it be an actor or a musician or whatever, and that person steals your girlfriend. I had heard, my friend had told me some story about his friend was like the biggest Flaming Lips fan, and that he took his girlfriend to some Flaming Lips show, and that the lead singer of the Flaming Lips stole his girlfriend. I don't think it's true. Like, it's almost years and years ago.
Right.
But I always thought, like, how, and it's basically this movie.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, that idea was, like, heart-wrenching that, you know, someone I admired would do that. And I don't know that, you know, and I think the movie doesn't stick it to him. Like, I think they're all very sensitive that it's an upsetting topic, but
it's weird. I didn't get the feeling he was upset that they were dating. What upset him is that this guy who has meant so much to him his whole life, like, who's both a mystery and like a guy whose very words he's been uncoding for years, it means so much to him, that those same words mean almost nothing to said musician, who's like, dismisses his own passions. Like, whatever, dude, it was nothing. Get over it.
And I think that scene in particular for me was where the movie really jumped a level. Mm-hmm. I thought that this idea that they were talking about it, I think you said it best, and right after the scene ended, Chris looked over at me and Rob and said, "Never meet your heroes." And I think that scene and his dealing with the idea of the almost casual cruelty of his hero's dismissal of his own work, and in a way his dismissal of his love for that work, I think, and his response to it was really thoughtful. It's a great scene, and it's really well acted and well written.
Right, and I think it does a really good job of that, because I think it explores the idea that, you know, O'Dowd kind of says something like, you know, it comes easy to you, so you don't think it means anything. And I think, like, that idea, having, you know, I think the movie does a good job with, you know, Hornby, of course, bringing that idea, the complexity of, when you love a thing, and the person who makes that doesn't love it like you love it. And I think that's what happens. And Chris is right. Like, I mean, I think that has happened to a lot of people I know. When you meet somebody famous, they're very casually dismissive of anybody. Most people I've met who are famous, they didn't care. I remember one time we met Mickey Rourke, and we were, like, so excited to meet Mickey Rourke. And we, you know, we just had bumped into him, and we were out one night, and our friends sort of dragged him over, and we immediately launched into, you know, how we were fans. And he immediately shut us down and asked us what we thought about motorcycles. That was what you want to talk about.
And if you know the Summers Brothers at all, that's not a topic you would ever ask us about.
Yeah, I've had both types of experiences.
Yeah.
But on the positive side, when I met Bob Mould, we actually got to be friends a little bit.
Right.
We hung out a couple times.
And then he stole your girlfriend.
Then he fucked my girlfriend. No, but we wouldn't.
Spoiler alert.
We wouldn't, because he's gay. But like, I was like, I'm sorry to do this, but Zen Arcade's like one of the best albums ever made, and I love it, and it changed my life. And he was like, wow, well, do you have any questions? And literally just talked to me about the album for fantastic. Like 10 minutes. And I was like, wow, this is who does that?
I mean, that's great.
Apparently Bob Mould.
Apparently Bob Mould, yeah.
I think another person we forgot to mention was Rose Byrne, who's the lead in the film.
Who's so good.
And is, of course, as I don't think I've ever seen a movie and thought, well, Rose Byrne didn't bring it. Like, she's gorgeous and funny and really likable and charming. And I think they do a great job. You know, it's funny. She's kind of a dazzling person, and I think the movie, despite that, even though she's kind of a movie star, I think you do buy her in the role, even though she's probably a little prettier and more sophisticated and more interesting than maybe that person would actually be in real life.
But she still feels so much – she and Ethan Hawke both feel so much like real people.
They do.
Which is
job.
The one flaw this movie really has, which is that Chris O'Dowd does not feel like
that's
one.
What I say. Yeah, he's just a little more – he's a little bit more in Bridesmaids than they are.
Yeah, it feels like if this had been more of an American production of this story, he thinks he's in that movie.
Right.
Like where it's everything is kind of emphasized, the comedy is kind of pumped up a little bit, everybody's a little bit more cartoonish, the situations are a little bit more outrageous. He's not totally, you know, out the door on this stuff, but just enough that he does feel kind of like a step out of place.
I think that's why the scene where he finally does talk to him at dinner about the work feels like, because it's kind of awkward. Like, you think when you meet somebody, it's not going to be awkward, but it kind of is. It's kind of, you know, Byrne even sort of seems to say, like, you know, this is impolite to sort of bring this stuff up. And he thinks, like, when am I going to talk to this guy again? Like, I'm going to bring this stuff up or whatever. So, I think the movie's, you know, and also, I don't think we mentioned Peretz's direction.
Jesse Peretz, who was one of the founding members of the Lemonheads and went on to become, who left right before they got famous. Oops.
He's got his own rock star story, I guess. But he's also he's a huge director. He directed videos for huge acts like the Foo Fighters. And now he directs, he's directed, you know, movies. And now he directed a lot of episodes of Girls. I think he directed a lot of the big episodes of Girls and stuff. So he's doing okay.
He landed
on his feet. I think he's okay.
Well, he's probably doing better than Evan Dando.
Yeah, he's probably doing better than the rest of the Lemonheads.
As far as the movies that he's made, I think this one is far and away.
Because his last one was, My Idiot Brother, I think?
Yeah. Our Idiot Brother.
Just fine.
I enjoyed it. It wasn't like a
It's not like out. This.
I'm not going to return to that movie. This one I could easily see returning to, like much like all the rest of the movies based on Hornby's work.
I have to say, I thought this was a really nice surprise.
We'll go into your final thoughts.
My final thoughts on this flick is, Russ and I really liked the movie while I was watching it. I was smiling the whole time. I really like what it's about. I think it nails everything it's up to. I would have to say, I really am, on the way here, Russ and I kept talking about the movie, and I have to say, I think this movie is as good as anything I've watched recently. I think it really, I really loved pretty much every minute of it. I thought it was sweet, I thought it was funny. You know, you don't have to make the Avengers. I think this movie is as good as that. I think this movie is as good as anything else I've really seen this year. I just really had a good time at this movie, and I really liked what it was about. Hawk's great. I don't know if we talked too much about how terrific he is as the sort of guy who blew it, or rock star or whatever.
The guy who's on the road to personal redemption.
Yeah, who's trying.
One line he has where it's like you live half your life and
you can't hit the reset button.
Yeah, you can't hit the reset button and you've got to still figure out a way to go on from there with the second half.
Right, which I think, again, the movie's just, it's so smart. I don't know that there is anybody I wouldn't recommend this movie to, unless you're just the person who just wants to watch like horror movies or something. But
not that there's anything wrong with
not
that.
Not there's anything Listen wrong with that, but I'm saying, like, you know, this might not be your cup of tea, as it were. But I thought this movie was great. I don't know that I could recommend a movie too much higher. So I'm gonna give it 9 out of 10 albums you just can't live without. So that was awesome.
Nice little high fidelity reference.
Thank you. Yeah.
What about you, Russ?
I'm gonna echo Rob's comments. Like I said, I was hoping it would be, you know, a nice little movie, and I was worried it was going to be kind of a letdown, and instead it was just a really well-developed, great time at the movies. I agree with Rob. Like, the more we talked about it, just the more excited I got. I think it's almost, if not quite, at high fidelity status for me. I mean, I was that impressed with it as a film. So, I agree with you guys on all of it, and I'm going to give it, you know, 11 out of 12 Ethan Hawke pictures from the 90s.
Nice. Boy, they had to go digging for some of those, right?
No it's way, like, man.
This seems like there must have been a million of them.
There's a treasure trove of them.
They're just like set photos from Reality Bites.
That's all you much. Need.
Yeah, this could be the story about that guy, like, getting old.
I think clearly that was part of the casting.
It could very well have been. You know, I do want to be clear, as much as I think this is a worthy film in that line of succession of the other Hornby. God, I keep wanting to say Hornsby. It's driving me crazy. Hornby.
Do it in your heart, Chris. Do it in your heart.
It's definitely the least a comedy of those films. I mean, it is definitely like those films are much bigger gag moments like than this does.
This doesn't have a Jack Black character.
No, this is much more of a drama than it is a comedy, but it's a drama that makes you feel good anyway.
Right.
You
know, I think to say that implies that it's some sort of sad downer, and it's not that at all.
Not that at all.
And there are some genuinely funny moments and throwaway lines.
Agreed. But I do want to be clear, if anyone goes in expecting a movie like High Fidelity, this is not like High Fidelity, and other than, yes, it is about an aging man-child who needs to figure out why he's a man-child and what's wrong, and has a lot of very deeply intense leveled characters in it. Because it really does. Everyone in here is really interesting. Even O'Dowd's character, which, like I said, is the one thing I'm critical of here, you can see a lot of interesting things about who he is, especially when the movie gets into its second half. He has some key moments in the film that are very important to making the film work. For sure. And like I said, I don't know why we keep largely skipping over Ethan Hawke, who I feel does exactly what he needs to do.
He's
here.
Awesome.
He is a loser, but he's not a caricature of a loser.
Right.
He is a rock star, but he's not a caricature of a rock star. He's kind of both at the same time and ends up just being kind of a guy who wants to live a normal life. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I'm going to give this 8.5 out of 10 shark eyes.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, somebody had to claim the shark eyes.
I thought so, too. It's so important. They spent a lot of time on it.
And don't forget to stay as the credits – keep watching after the credits start, because you get to see a final Chris O'Dowd sequence that actually, in retrospect of everything, is quite funny.
Yeah. is that it? Did we finish? Oh, I wanted to mention the music's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. The music is pretty good. I was going to say, who did the music in this thing?
Hawk sings a bunch of it.
Hawk, who actually, you know whose voice reminded me when he's singing? The guy from Wilco.
Yeah.
Totally.
He sounds like Jeff Tweedy.
He totally does.
Yeah.
Was it Jeff Tweedy or is it the other one? I forget which is which.
It's Jeff Tweedy.
Is it Jeff Tweedy? Okay. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sounds like that guy. Whatever.
Consult your local Google.
Yeah. Before we sign off, I guess we got to figure out if Chris is really Jimi Hendrix.
Well, like,
play the first side of Are You Experienced. Play it, Chris.
I don't even have a guitar anymore.
Oh,
I destroyed all my guitars.
You have to do that. If you're
I was tripping in on stage, but you know.
Yeah.
I set him on fire.
Yeah.